our presentation today, we had a typo in the title. The correct title should be Disability Discrimination During the Pandemic by Mitchell Hagopian. And this presentation relates to our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Mitchell Hagopian is an attorney with Disability Rights Wisconsin, the protection and advocacy agency for people with disabilities in Wisconsin. He also served on SDMAC's Ethics Subcommittee and its Vaccine Allocation Committee. He is a 1985 graduate of the UW Law School. Thank you for joining us today, Mitch.
Thanks. Happy to be here. So talk a little bit about who we are, in case you don't know. Disability Rights Wisconsin is the protection and advocacy system for people with disabilities in Wisconsin. We've been around for about 45 years. Every state has a protection and advocacy agency, and we're the one for Wisconsin. The bulk of our money comes from the federal government to advocate on behalf of people with all types of disabilities. We started out as the protection and advocacy agency for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, but over the years, that's expanded to cover every type of disability and other issues that sort of surround disability, but are not necessarily disability specific. So for example, we have a protection and advocacy grant specifically dealing with accessing voting rights, and another one that is directed at assistive technology issues for people with any kind of a disability. And in addition to that, we have several now what are state-funded grants that allow us to expand our advocacy to people who are in the various long-term care programs that serve people with disabilities in Wisconsin. And also the federal disability system that, provides income sustenance plus medical care to people. So we're pretty big. We actually have like 60 employees. We have three brick and mortar offices, the biggest ones in Madison, one in Milwaukee, and then one in Rice Lake. So I'm going to get right into the icky stuff. So when you're talking about discrimination against people with disabilities in the COVID era, we always look at it in terms of kind of the historical perspective. And it's a pretty ugly one in the United States. For about the past, 100 years or so, we've had some problems. But starting off with what I assume most people are somewhat familiar with, and that is the eugenics movement in the early 20th century and late 19th century. Very popular with, intellectuals. And originally it was, sort of a movement that would encourage people of certain genetic backgrounds to, procreate with each other voluntarily, but it turned into a movement of actual like state engineered social Darwinism. And in its heyday, actually Wisconsin or the United States, we sterilized 70,000 people with intellectual disabilities in order to prevent them from procreating so we could cleanse the gene pool. A bunch of states, including Wisconsin, passed laws that permitted this to happen. Culminated in 1927 went in this Supreme Court decision, Buck v. Bell, where Oliver Wendell Holmes, who a lot of people think of as the great dissenter and protector of rights, in determining that the, I think it was the West Virginia law was constitutional, he said that three generations of imbeciles are enough. So, and the laws in that made up the American eugenics laws were used as the basis for the eugenics laws in Nazi Germany during the Second World War. And I mean, that had obviously horrible consequences for people involved. The Nazis sterilized 400,000 people with disabilities and killed 70,000 of them between 1937 and 1941. So even before the concentration camps were up and running, they were exterminating people with disabilities, mostly through neglect of people in institutions. So Wisconsin isn't immune to this. Between 1913 and 1963, we sterilized 1,800 people. Most of these occurred at the three state centers for the intellectually disabled that we still have in Wisconsin. Central Center here in Wisconsin, Southern Center in Racine, and the Northern Center in Chippewa Falls. And our law, which permitted this, which I always like to read because it's kind of, so when it was on the books, we appointed a surgeon and what they called in those days an alienist, which we now call a psychologist. These two people plus the superintendent of whatever institution that they were looking at had the authority to make this decision. And the law read, if such experts and superintendent unanimously find that procreation is inadvisable, it shall be lawful to perform such operation for the prevention of procreation as shall be decided safest and most effective. And that law was actually on our books until 1978, it wasn't repealed till then. Another area of historical discrimination against people with disabilities occurred in the area of mental health treatment. And I think most people are familiar with the lobotomy movement that was popular from the late 30s to the mid 60s. We lobotomized 50,000 people with mostly mild mental illnesses in that period of time. And a lot of these were what are called ice pick lobotomies, where the principal physician who was behind this, he would actually drive around in a vehicle, in a car, and go to places and do these ice pick lobotomies. Basically was they would break the bone between your nose and your eye socket and stick a probe in there and scramble your frontal lobe. Very nice. So I think the question is, you know, where are we now? Well, here's where we are. This is a quote from Donald Trump from last fall. You have good genes. You know that, right? You have good genes. A lot of it is about the genes, isn't it? Don't you believe the racehorse theory? You think we're so different? You have good genes in Minnesota. So yeah, in 2020, we're still talking about things like this. But it's not just that. There's other places where in the medical area, this is a problem. I don't know if people recall this about 15 years ago now, I think it is. There was quite a controversy about what was called the Ashley treatment, which was basically as a young girl was approaching puberty, who had pretty severe intellectual disability. Well, actually not that severe of an intellectual disability, but she had an intellectual disability. Her parents, in conjunction with physicians from the University of Washington Hospital, went ahead and gave her a hysterectomy, provided her with growth inhibiting therapy, and removed her breast buds, all in an attempt to basically keep her as a child and not to have to bother with that whole maturation and menstruation thing, which would be so inconvenient for the caregivers. That actually ended up to be quite controversial, although there were people on both sides of that debate. Ultimately, the University of Washington did apologize for what it had engaged in, has subsequently changed the way it handles such issues. The other area where this comes up still today is in the issue with the issue of quality of life. For people with disabilities, especially intellectual disabilities, especially very severe intellectual disabilities, people have justified withholding life-sustaining medical treatment because of a subjective belief, usually on the part of the people who are in control of that treatment, that the person has no quality of life and therefore is better off dead. And this comes up a lot. We've had cases here in our office where people with intellectual disabilities have had basic, I mean, we're not talking about like serious invasive treatments being denied to people. We're talking about people who are denied antibiotics in an attempt to allow a pneumonia to get worse and cause the death of a person. Basic artificial, like G-tube feedings that pre-existed like an illness, and people discontinue them based on this idea that the person has no quality of life. Basically, that's whenever we see that statement in anything, we recognize it as a code for discrimination against people with intellectual disabilities. Other issues that come up with this, physician attitudes towards people with disabilities. There's actually a study, a couple of academicians have studied this, and they, you know, were surveying doctors and social workers and educators. And of those three groups, the doctors were significantly more pessimistic about the possibility of, you know, a quality future life for a person with disability. And that implicit bias, they didn't even recognize that they had it, affected the treatment decisions and the options that they offered. Moving us into the present day, which is COVID, nothing like a pandemic to remind us that we still are not quite there yet. So you probably, a year ago or a little more than a year ago when this all started, the big issue, people thought that the main way you were going to treat severe COVID was through the use of ventilators, which are, you know, artificial breathing mechanisms. And so the initial focus in COVID, because there was no possibility of a vaccine and there was no one really knew had any medications to treat it. So they're just more worried about keeping people breathing. Ventilator allocation and ventilator shortages were a big issue early on. And so states were developing policies, and this is an example of one. Alabama created a policy that directed them not to allow mechanical ventilation to patients with severe or profound mental retardation, dementia, or severe traumatic brain injury. This policy, together with many of the other ones, which here's one other one, in Tennessee in their crisis standards of care, had kind of a similar thing. Neuromuscular disease, cancer, TBI, traumatic brain injury, and dementia, those conditions were excluded from their crisis care allocations. Most of these policies were deemed discriminatory by the Department of Health Services Office of Civil Rights, and they have, most of them have been changed, and the problematic language has been removed from them. In Wisconsin, it happened here. Initially, I think Peggy noted that I'm on the State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee. So I was on the Ethics Committee, and I was on the Vaccine Distribution Committee as a representative for people with disabilities. And as we were developing first the ethical framework, which would then lead to how we would distribute vaccine and any treatments that came, that were developed. We had a process, and one of the things, a basic ethical principle that we recognized we needed to have is that we didn't want any of the policies that resulted from any of this stuff to be discriminatory. I didn't happen to be on the little subgroup that was drafting the section on anti-discrimination, but when it came out, the first draft, they had the usual list of people you're not supposed to discriminate against, sex, age, race, you know, gender, any of those things, but not disability. Disability wasn't included in that list initially, which I was frankly shocked that that wouldn't be included because I thought we were beyond that at least. So they agreed, yeah, that was kind of an oversight. I guess we probably ought to not discriminate against people with disabilities. And so they added in disability, but when they did, they made it conditioned. So I'll just read you kind of the way this developed. Sorry, I'm looking at my papers here. I'm not sure what I did with it. I'll be darned. Anyway, basically what they did when they did add in disability, then they put, you know, as long as the disability is not related to like a respiratory infection. Well, nobody else had that. ultimately, it was, you know, that also got removed. But just, I mean, it's kind of interesting. The second to final version, the one that actually went out for public comment on this thing, had disability after incarceration status, which I personally didn't care about, but I thought it was a little bit unusual that people with disabilities in the order of priority were behind people who were incarcerated. So anyway, it was eventually fixed, but it was surprising to me that we were actually still having this conversation, and the people who were drafting this stuff were people who I would have thought would have known better. So couple things when you're talking about distribution of treatments, especially initially when we were talking about ventilators, you know, we're trying to figure out how do we allocate scarce resources. And so one of the ways that a lot of, you know, human services agencies and have dealt with this is by looking at something called SOFA and PLOD. SOFA stands for Sequential Organ Failure Assessment Tool. And basically what it is if you're an adult and you go into a hospital and you're really sick, they assess like six body systems to determine what your functioning is and to basically determine what your likelihood is of surviving that hospitalization. And the PLOD is a similar thing, but for children. And some of those scores, one of the scores within the SOFA is the Glasgow Coma Scale. And in that, you get a lower score if you can't speak. And it doesn't really, the score doesn't really ask why you can't speak. They assume it's because you're so sick that you just are unable to speak, but that's not what you're scored on. If you can't speak because you have a intellectual or developmental disability or you have autism that prevents you from speaking or communicating clearly, you get the same score as the person who's, you know, really sick and just isn't speaking at that particular time, which has the effect of adding points to your SOFA score, which if it's used to allocate a ventilator means your score is higher than the one that is gonna get you the ventilator. So we dealt with that by, you know, commenting to the people in Wisconsin, which in those at the beginning was the full state disaster medical advisory committee, about why that was not a good idea, and gave them suggestions for how they could incorporate those scores, but how they would need to be adjusted to account for disability as opposed to illness. And the same thing happened with life expectancy. If you're using life expectancy as a criterion for distributing scarce resources, that automatically discriminates against people with disabilities because so many disabilities have shorter life expectancy as one of their effects. That also has the effect of discriminating against a lot of racial minorities. needs as well. Sorry. And then another one was, if you were going to need post-hospital support services, that was sometimes a criteria in these things. So not in Wisconsin, but in other places it was. We did end up doing a statement. This is our statement on triage policies that we issued. You can read it. A lot of what I've just said. And we did write a letter to all the hospitals in Wisconsin because the state ended up not adopting ventilator distribution guidelines. It was too hot of a potato for them to come up with actual direction on. So we ended up contacting each of the hospitals and giving them actually about a 10-page letter telling them how they could avoid discrimination in their distribution of ventilators. And finally, vaccine. After our ethics committee came up with its protocols for, you know, how the ethical principles that were underneath distribution of vaccine, and there was another committee that worked on treatments. Now it seems already like ancient history when there wasn't enough vaccine for everyone who wanted to get it. Remember those days? 13 weeks ago. And, when we finally got it, there was a large number of people who really wanted to get it. And the state prioritized them, initially with the people who were most at risk of, the people we needed to stay healthy, which were the healthcare workers, because we had all these people, especially in November and December and January, getting sick and overwhelming the healthcare system. So they were the first group, along with people in long-term care facilities, because that's where people were mostly dying. So they were in the very first group to get the initial doses of the Pfizer vaccine. And then shortly after that, we moved to people age 65, because the vast majority of the deaths from this disease were occurring in that age group. So those were all appropriate factors to consider. And after that, we moved into what we called on the ethics or this our subcommittee, the 1B group. And that's basically, okay, now we're through the low-hanging fruit here in terms of people we absolutely got to do something about. Now what do we do? And this is where your value judgments really come into play. And people with comorbidities, which included all sorts of things like heart disease, respiratory conditions, immunosuppressive diseases, developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities. We did not prioritize that group of people. They were moved behind. We prioritized above that group of people, essential workers, so public transit workers, teachers, food supply, food chain people, and mink farmers of all things. I don't know if anyone noticed that, but there's a reason for that one. It was because of cross species transmission and it tended to create different variants of the disease we didn't really like. So, but it was an odd one to have in there. The elder advocates and me, the disability advocate, fought hard to get at least one group of people with comorbidities included in the 1B group, the second group to be covered. And that was people who are in the state's community-based long-term care programs, their family care and IRIS. And our justification for that is these are all people who would be in nursing homes if, in terms of meeting the level of care, they qualified to be there. They weren't there only because we had community-based alternatives, but each one of these people in these programs had some serious comorbidity. And in addition to that, they needed assistance typically with at least three activities of daily living and multiple instrumental activities of daily living. So this is a population that we could identify because we knew where they were. They had each one of them had a case manager, and we could have gotten the vaccine to them quickly. So it was a big fight, but we were able to convince the state to put that one small cohort of all these people with comorbidities into that 1B group. And we were pleased about that and happy about it. We had to justify it, but we did, we were able to do that. But then once we got them in and that group became eligible, and there was about a month between when we knew they were going to be eligible and when they became eligible. And the assumption during that whole time was that all the people who were in this 1B, which included all the essential workers, teachers, everybody else, that they would all become eligible on the same day, just like everybody else in the one the earlier groups had. But when they did finally open this up, they put the long-term care group as actually second behind the educators. And our committee had not agreed to that or planned to do that. And the and this was a big deal 10 weeks ago because there were about 250,000 educators, which means that this group of people with comorbidities, people with disabilities, was going to be placed behind those 250,000 people plus the 750,000 people who were covered in the 1A group. So it would have had the effect of moving that people, this group back in terms of vaccine eligibility for another, you know, 5 or 6 weeks. We pushed back and the state recanted that position and did that. But, you know, what this shows you, or shows us, maybe not you, but shows us, was that throughout this whole system and this process, people with disabilities, the kind of the attitudes that they're devalued, they're still there. A lot of it now, it's not the same as, you know, we're going to sterilize you to make sure that we don't have any more of you. It's not explicit like that. It's good people who just don't think about it and don't see what they're doing. But it's out there. It's one of the reasons we definitely need the Americans with Disabilities Act. I will say on the good side, because I'd prefer to end on a good note after all this nasty stuff I've been telling you. And that is, you know, the bottom line is we did fix all these problems, which 50 years ago, that might not have been possible. But you know, the disability advocacy movement has been successful in raising these issues with policymakers. And so, you know, we had to deal with them again. We shouldn't have to deal with them, but we did. And I'm glad to say that, you know, it's worked out okay. And I'm really, really, really happy that there's enough vaccine now for at least everybody who wants to get it. So, okay, I'll shut up. I think I went over time. I apologize. And I will stop sharing my screen. We just do it by pushing ourselves in. That's how we did it. Initially, that State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee, which was made up almost exclusively of physicians and a couple of medical ethicists, and immediately it became evident that it needed a broader representation. And so we did Disability Rights Wisconsin. We're part of something called the Survival Coalition, which is a coalition of groups that advocate on behalf of people with disabilities. And we did advocate strongly for them to include two disability advocates on that larger committee. So right now the head of the what's called the University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities, the USED, which you will know as it's a big part of the Waisman Center here at the UW Medical School. The head of that is now on the medical advisory committee. And so is a nurse, a retired nurse from something called the Wisconsin Inclusive Nursing Program. And that woman is a nurse who specializes in treating people, the medical needs of people with intellectual disabilities and helping them and navigate the medical system and helping the medical system understand their unique needs in terms of communication issues and things like that. So we do now have representation on that. It's just, you know, it's a matter of constant vigilance. You know, our committee that dealt with the vaccine distribution, we had disability, we had aging, we had, minority group representation. What group didn't we have? It's a group that's really become marginalized in Wisconsin. That is workers. There was nobody from a union or any workers' rights organization on that committee. I mean, in addition to advocating for people with disabilities, I found myself like, well, we probably ought to get the bus drivers, you know, vaccinated too. They'd be a good population. And, you know, because no one else was talking about them. I mean, there wasn't even a member of the teachers union on there. Now they had, everybody wanted the teachers to get vaccinated so our kids could go back to school, which totally appropriate. I'm with them on that. But you would think that they would have thought to have put somebody from the labor movement onto that thing, but nope. So, and they didn't push, apparently. They're not as, you know, nosy as I am. So. Well, actually, our position was pretty, ours was pretty rigid, and that was that actually that doesn't matter, partly because, well, life expectancy for an individual is a really difficult thing to predict. I don't know if anyone's been involved with the hospice system, but there's an awful lot of people who have 6 months to live who've been on hospice for 6 or 10 years. But I understand where you're coming from. But the science is that, and what we did think was okay was if they were going to determine that this patient was not likely to survive the hospitalization because of the severity of their infection, that was something they could consider. But apart from that, there's just not a lot of science that supports the general life expectancy thing. You know, like if you're 60, you're going to live till you're 90, that kind of thing. We didn't want that because it was just, it would have excluded a whole bunch of people that shouldn't have been. But if you weren't going to, if you were likely not to survive the actual hospitalization, that was something they could consider. In the letter we sent to the hospitals, we took a position that was, I'm not sure I'm still comfortable with it. And that was that they could consider whether someone was going to be, would still be alive within 6 months after the hospitalization. So we did, and that was based on conversations we had with other national disability rights groups. So we did sort of recognize that, but. Well, you could choose a 15-year-old by telling them, what, you got a 15-year-old out there? Then don't take me. And that's one way to deal with it. And I think a whole bunch of older people would have said that. I probably would have said that. And, you know, but the question is, can a hospital do that? I mean, if you looked at the original ventilator guidelines that they were working with, if there was a tie, like you had two people had the same SOFA score that I talked about. So they both had the same, you know, expectation of surviving the hospitalization. If they were both 30 years old, one was born on January 1st and the other one was born on January 2nd, the guy from January 1st would get it. That's where we were with that. So like, yeah. We cannot be having that. And we cannot have anybody who's older, you know, I mean, that would have excluded all of the older people, not just the ones who would voluntarily decide that they didn't want to take up a spot, you know. Kind of a lifeboat thing. It's basically, they look at it's pretty complicated. It's not a simple system. They look at different tests that are supposed to be objective. Some of them will be lab tests for certain body systems. One we were most concerned about was its coma score, which, you know, is basically designed to look at how conscious you are. And that's the one that gets mixed up with people who have a lot of long-term disabilities that creates the same symptoms, you know, or appearance as someone who is unconscious because of they're in a coma. A person with autism who can't speak is not in a coma, but they can't speak. So if you're looking at the coma score, that particular score, they'd get like a zero. Because they don't speak, even though they're perfectly conscious, and they don't speak when they're perfectly healthy. They just don't speak. And it didn't differentiate between, you know, those types of people. Yeah. Yeah. It was the Vaccine Allocation Subcommittee of the State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee. And you could have watched us every Tuesday and Friday morning from 7 to 8 in the morning. We were on TV having our public discussion of all this stuff. And every time we would propose something, we put it out for public comment. The 1A thing wasn't everybody, there was pretty much universal agreement that healthcare workers, people in nursing homes and needed to be vaccinated first because we needed healthcare workers and people in nursing homes were, it was a wiping them out. So we needed to get those people protected. And same with the 65-year-olds, which actually the state just did that without even consulting us. When we got to 1B, you know, then we're making all these value judgments about different groups and their value and why we would do it and all that. Again, it was all done in public. And we put our initial recommendation out for public comment. We got 5,000 public comments in a week on that. Unbelievable. I had and they took our committee and separated us into, you know, little groups to review, you know, substantive areas of comments. And I was on the little group that reviewed the people who were commenting on the fact that we weren't going to put people with comorbidities into the mix. And there were like 650 comments just on that. And I mean, some of these stories are just like, it breaks your heart. I'm telling you, you know, I've got an immunocompromised condition. I haven't been out of my house in, you know, a year. I haven't seen anybody at all. You know, can't you please put me above the mink workers? You know what I mean? It's like, wow, it was bad. It was hard, you know, and we fought to get the one discrete group of people with comorbidities covered, figuring, because a lot of this early on, it's not just values of who we like better or who's more valuable to society. Part of it, another part of the conversation was, well, if we pick this group of people, will we be able to actually get the vaccine into their arms? So that's a problem. If you got, you know, if you make everybody with diabetes eligible, that's not a group that's necessarily that easy to find. You know, they're not a discrete group that walks around, you know, with the diabetes group. So you would end up spending a lot of resources trying to find these people and that would potentially delay vaccine getting into people's arms and slow the process down. And so our argument behind covering this, there were about 50,000 people in the long-term, we call it the long-term care group. That group's actually bigger, but a bunch of those people were already vaccinated because they were over the age of 65 or they were in substitute care facilities that had been covered. But there were about 50,000 people, mostly younger people with disabilities, who weren't. And our part of our argument was this is a discrete group of people. We know who they are. We know where they live. Each one of them has a case manager because they're in this specialized program that we have. And we could actually get the vaccine to them reasonably, effectively, and efficiently. So that was our argument. It wasn't because, you know, they're more deserving than people with immunocompromised conditions or severe respiratory ailments or diabetes, any of those things. Because a lot of those people were at just as great a risk of death or serious outcomes from COVID as a group that we were arguing for. But we thought the state ought to make some effort to cover some people who were sick and who were at risk of death from this disease. And that was our way of, you know, sort of like presenting a group where we could do that effectively.
Mitch, thank you for coming and speaking with us today. And thank you for all the work you did for the state and for taking care of people. And
my pleasure. Nice to meet all you guys. Have a lovely Sunday.